Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about Northwestern Energy, federal recognition for the Little Shell Tribe, and the Flathead Water Compact. It's Wednesday, December 11th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes would manage the National Bison Range in exchange for concessions on water rights. According to draft legislation, Montana Senator Steve Daines is expected to introduce in Congress. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
Both Daines and the Salish and Kootenai tribes announced last week that they had come to an agreement to settle thousands of water rights claims otherwise destined for court. That settlement is outlined in legislation Daines is set to introduce in the Senate. MTPR gained access to a draft copy of the bill. It would also transfer management of the National Bison Range on the reservation from the federal government to the tribes in exchange for concessions they made on their water rights. As part of the deal, the tribes would agree to lower the amount of federal funding they would receive for an irrigation project by $400 million. In an emailed statement, Daines said the settlement, quote, will also save taxpayers $1 to $2 million per year, end quote. Daines says those ongoing savings would come from the tribe's management of the bison range, which they have long sought to do. The federal government would hold the range in trust for the tribes. Tribal Chairman Ronald Trahan issued this pre-recorded statement on the exchange.
Restoring the bison range to federal trust ownership for the tribes is an elegant solution that would correct the historic injustice of the United States taking the bison range from the tribe's treaty-reserved homeland without tribal consent.
Daines is expected to introduce the legislation later this week. The move follows over a decade of negotiation that went into the CSKT Water Compact, which Daines' legislation is based on. That agreement was approved by the state legislature in 2015 and has been waiting for congressional approval. Daines says his bill is a settlement and does not require approval from state lawmakers. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana's governor has requested a disaster designation from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for 11 counties that reported significant weather-related crop losses. The Billings Gazette reported Democratic Governor Steve Bullock has submitted the request to Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue. Approval of the request covering 2019 weather damage would make affected producers eligible for emergency loans and other federal emergency assistance programs. Officials say approval or disapproval of a disaster designation is the final step in a multi-part review process after a governor submits a request. Richland County has cited a likely loss of $6.9 million in sugar beet crops alone. Montana's largest utility company says it needs to nearly double its electricity generation to keep up with customer demands for power during winter freezes and summer heat waves. Northwestern Energy's long-term plan for electricity supply in the state is now in front of regulators for review. Critics said Monday the plan leans too heavily on fossil fuels, but the company says renewable energy alternatives are too expensive and unreliable. Kayla DeRoche reports.
The Montana Public Service Commission took public comment Monday on Northwestern Energy's long-term electricity supply plan. The plan is a projection and includes Northwestern's analysis of the most cost-effective and reliable way to meet energy demands in the state. Northwestern Energy economist Ben Fitch-Fleischman said the company looked at many different models of energy production.
What our plan finds is it typically selects, when we do the optimization model and say we've got these scenarios, what resources are selected to meet our needs, it typically selects a natural gas-fired peaking unit.
According to a Northwestern Energy overview, the plan outlines a gas-reliant model that prioritizes affordability and reliability, with a need to solicit bids for more company-owned power generation resources. The plan shows Northwestern is consistently under capacity when trying to meet the peak customer demand of 1,400 megawatts, and it buys heavily from the market. The company says it purchased about half of its peak requirement this year. Northwestern aims to change that. The plan outlines its intention to add 200 megawatts of capacity per year, with a goal of 725 extra megawatts by 2025. Northwestern says it will consider a variety of energy sources to hit that goal, but added renewable energy is less capable of meeting peak energy needs than natural gas and is currently more expensive. 61% of its power currently comes from wind, solar, and hydro generation. Around 50 protesters stood outside the Public Service Commission office in Helena before Monday's public comment meeting. They called for regulators to push Northwestern Energy away from fossil fuel-based energy sources. Jeff Smith with the activist group 350 Montana helped organize the rally.
We can make this transition from carbon-based energy to 100% renewable clean energy in the next several years.
After the rally, about 30 people headed inside to give public comment advocating for the development of renewable energy infrastructure and use. They talked about the need to increase clean energy to head off the damage of climate change and urged the PSC to reject the plan based on its failure to fully incorporate renewable energy into future power development plans. They expressed dismay that Northwestern intends to continue investing in the Colstrip Power Plant despite an apparent trend in utilities switching from coal to renewable energy. No one who gave public comment spoke in support of the plan. PSC Commissioner Roger Koopman said regulators won't vote up or down on Northwestern's plan, but in the coming months, commissioners will publicly comment on it.
The plan is sort of a roadmap. It isn't something that they have to stick with. But it sure is an indicator of the direction Northwestern is going.
Northwestern Energy updates its resource procurement plan every 2 years as required under state law. Following new legislation this past session, it will review it every 3 years in the future. The PSC held two public meetings on the Northwestern Energy Resource Procurement Plan in Helena Monday. It will hold a listening session in Missoula next week and in Billings and Lewistown in January. The comment period ends January 3rd. With reporting from Corin Cates Carney at Montana Public Radio, I'm Kayla DeRoche with Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Yellowstone Public Radio has received corporate support from Northwestern Energy. Montana's largest electricity provider yesterday announced its plans to buy a larger share of the Colstrip Power Plant, a day after protesters rallied the company to increase its renewable energy portfolio. Nikki Ouellette reports.
Northwestern Energy on Tuesday announced it plans to buy an additional 25% stake in Colstrip Unit 4 for $1, a deal some are calling similar to what Montana lawmakers rejected earlier this year. But Vice President of Supply and Montana Government Relations, John Hines, says the contract with Washington-based Puget Sound Energy has some key differences, beginning with the Montana Public Service Commission retaining regulatory oversight and Puget Sound still being on the hook for some cleanup costs for its past share of the plant.
Three, we are stating up front that there will be zero increase in customers' rates this first year. Fourth, this concept we're happy to show during the regulatory approval that it is the lowest cost means of meeting the capacity concerns.
Hines says the additional 185 megawatts will meet about a quarter of the company's capacity needs, which he says are severely undermet. But environmental groups are calling the proposal, announced a day after Northwestern presented a 20-year energy supply plan to state regulators, a sweetheart deal that puts Northwestern customers on the hook for expensive maintenance and repair costs.
It spent 20 minutes telling people about its resource plan, and it failed to tell everybody the real news of the day, which it was going to do the opposite of what people wanted them to do.
Ann Hedges is with the nonprofit advocacy group Montana Environmental Information Center. She says Northwestern hasn't released an analysis of the cost of buying more into Colstrip or indicated how much it's paying for coal.
Hold on to your wallets. This $1 is the most expensive $1 you'll ever have spent.
John Hines with Northwestern says a cost-benefit analysis wasn't possible during contract negotiations due to confidentiality agreements. He says state regulators will have a chance to weigh in when the company files an application for pre-approval in January or February. Also on Tuesday, Northwestern committed to reducing the carbon intensity of its energy generation in Montana by 90% by 2045 compared to 2010. Hines says it's an actionable goal the company can hit by ending contracts with generation sources that emit more carbon per megawatt than Colstrip. He expects the Colstrip plant to emit less carbon over time and that Northwestern will increase renewable power generation.
And I refer to this as a really a no BS carbon goal.
Hedges with MEIC says it's exactly that.
Bullshit. That is a complete pile of BS. You don't buy more coal and still plan on buying more gas, which they say they're going to do, and at the same time say they understand the need to decrease their carbon pollution.
Hedges says Colstrip is Northwestern's biggest net carbon emitter and that the company should look to wind, solar, and hydro for a cleaner, cheaper energy source. Northwestern says the Colstrip purchase would lower its renewable and carbon-free energy sources from 60% to 56%. Other owners of the Colstrip power plant have indicated they plan to pull out as early as 2025. Northwestern has indicated it foresees maintaining stake in the plant into the 2040s. The Montana Public Service Commission and Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission are expected to consider the proposal early next year. Colstrip's older two units, 1 and 2, are scheduled to close earlier than expected in the coming months after their plant operator said they couldn't make the units economically viable. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians is poised to get federal recognition any day now. Once the must-pass defense bill clears Congress, the Montana tribe will receive a land base and be eligible for federal funds after a generations-long struggle. Olivia Reingold reports.
Little Shell Chairman Gerald Gray says he prays every morning. He smudges and asks his ancestors for federal recognition. Tuesday morning was a little different, though. He was
thanking them for helping us get through this and seeing the day that we never thought would come has finally arrived.
Federal recognition for the tribe is embedded within the National Defense Authorization Act, an annual bill that's cleared Congress for nearly six decades. It would grant the tribe a 200-acre land base and make it eligible for federal dollars from agencies like the Bureaus of Indian Affairs and Indian Education. The tribe, which is headquartered in Great Falls and is about 5,500 members strong, has been recognized by the state for almost two decades, but never by the federal government. It's something the tribe has been pushing for since treaty talks over 100 years ago. Now, recognition seems imminent. Chairman Gray, who has no health insurance, says he looks forward to coverage by the Indian Health Service, but that this is about more than the federal benefits.
The dignity was always been kind of in question. You know, are you really an Indian? Well, yeah, we always knew we were, but as other tribes and non-Indians looked at us, it's like, well, you're not federally recognized.
Acknowledgement has seemed in reach before. Montana's congressional delegation has been trying to pass Little Shell recognition bills for over a decade, although standalone bills proved tough to move. Last year, a bill to recognize the tribe cleared the House, but died in the Senate by one vote. That's why, even though this bill is considered a must-pass piece of legislation, Chairman Gray says he kept pulling up the defense bill last night.
Just to see what page we're on, page 1802. And just to look back and make sure it's there. And then, of course, you're always like, wow.
A Little Shell recognition bill was the first piece of legislation Democratic Senator John Tester ever introduced in the U.S. Senate. Now, seeing it so close to the finish line.
The light is at the end of the tunnel. We can see the smoke coming out of the train. It's coming.
He's introduced it every Congress since and says the bill's current language is nearly verbatim of what he put forth in 07. Republican Senator Steve Daines has been a consistent supporter and co-sponsor of the bill, first in the House and then the Senate. He declined an interview but sent this pre-recorded message.
We got really close last December down to the one-yard line, didn't quite get it in the end zone. Now we're going to stick it in the end zone.
Assuming the bill passes, the Little Shell will become one of 24 tribes that have been recognized through Congress since 1960. That's according to a previous press release from Republican Congressman Greg Gianforte, who helped get a standalone version of the bill through the House for each of the past 2 years. Earlier this year, he urged his peers to keep Little Shell recognition in the National Defense Act as the House and Senate reconciled the differences between their bills. The conferencing process took months and just wrapped this week. Now the House is expected to vote on the bill Wednesday. Then the Senate will do the same early next week. Chairman Gray says he's already planning a party, but knows it's D.C., where anything can happen. So he says he'll wait for the ink to dry. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Olivia Reingold is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America core member. We now turn to Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney, who brings us an update on the long-awaited Flathead Water Compact.
With Montana News, I'm Corin Cates Carney. A bill proposing to settle long-disputed water rights claims between the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and the federal government includes a massive new bargaining chip, transferring the National Bison Range to control of the tribes. U.S. Senator Steve Daines is expected to introduce a bill to do that as early as this week. John Adams is the editor-in-chief of the Montana Free Press and covered the breaking news today. He joins us now to share his reporting. John, thanks for joining us on Montana Public Radio.
Happy to be here.
So before we dive into the details about how the National Bison Range became a part of this water rights settlement, can you give us a refresher on where the CSKT Water Compact stands now?
Well, of course, the CSKT Water Compact was first passed by the Montana Legislature in 2015, and that was the state portion of a larger negotiation that also required not only approval by the federal government, but a settlement between the tribes and the federal government over past water rights claims, basically damages that the federal government was responsible for to water on the reservation and off the reservation. So not just on the Flathead Indian Reservation in the Flathead Valley around Flathead Lake, but also the Aboriginal lands that the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes had occupied prior to white settlement. So these are areas that span a large portion of western Montana where the tribes once lived in time immemorial before white settlers arrived in the west.
How do these two kind of massive issues, the CSKT Water Compact and the National Bison Range, become entwined? Your report today said that the National Bison Range will be returned to the tribes in this Water Compact bill.
Well, the National Bison Range will be restored is the language, and what that means is that it will no longer be part of the National Refuge System, but instead will be held in federal trust for the tribes, which is the status that it had prior to 1908 when the federal government, by an act of Congress signed by Teddy Roosevelt, took the land through the use of eminent domain, an action that was deemed later by the courts in 1971 as an illegal taking by the federal government.
And in getting both of these issues wrapped together in one bill now that is not public yet, but sounds like Senator Daines is planning to introduce it maybe this week, are there concessions that the tribe had to make either on the side of water rights or management of the National Bison Range to get these two things put together?
Yeah, so under the original Hellgate Treaty, the tribes still had water rights. They had the right to fish. Hunt and fish in their Aboriginal lands, and that included all of these waters, even outside the reservation. And so under this negotiated settlement, the tribe has agreed to give up the vast majority of those off-reservation water rights in places throughout western Montana and southwestern Montana, and even out into central Montana. They no longer are going to hang on to those rights. They're going to relinquish those rights in exchange for the $1.9 billion settlement to repair and improve the Flathead irrigation system, as well as regaining control and oversight over the National Bison Range.
And were the tribes a part of the negotiations to wrap the Bison Range into the Water Compact settlement?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The tribe was very much involved. In fact, the negotiation primarily was between Senator Daines and the tribe. This compact process in the federal settlement, these are things that have been happening for years and years and years, both at the state and the federal level. This wasn't something that was just arrived at overnight. By the time it became a proposal for legislation, there had been a tremendous amount of negotiation between the Department of Interior, the state DNRC, the tribes, et cetera. And so we're now at a point where it's passed at the state level, it's now being introduced at the federal level, and this should be, we should be seeing the end of the last Montana Indian Water Rights Compact here in the next year.
For those who have been watching this issue for a long time, what are the distinctions about what passed in the Montana state legislature in 2015 in the Water Compact, and now what's being negotiated, including this addition of the National Bison Range on the federal level?
There are two separate but sort of parallel tracks here. One is the state negotiation with the tribes over the tribes' rights to state waters and state lands. And then there's the negotiation that the tribe has with the federal government over the liabilities that the federal government has in damages that they've done to tribal waters. First, the Montana negotiation had to pass. That was the passage of the CSKT Water Compact in 2015 by the Montana legislature. Then it goes to the federal government for consideration. Senator John Tester first brought a bill in 2016 that would essentially just implemented what the state had negotiated. That didn't pass, and it required bipartisan support in a Republican legislature. So it needed the support of Montana's Republican Senator Steve Daines. What Senator Daines has been negotiating since that is a deal that not only, in his view, a better deal for the federal government and for the people of Montana, but a fair deal for the tribes. And so what they've come up with is this negotiation, and this has been going on for a long time. And, you know, from the folks I talked to, this has been a very heated at times negotiation between some of these folks, because there are a lot of people, particularly in the Flathead Valley, who are concerned, outright opposed to the passage of the compact or a federal settlement, who think that even at $1.9 billion, which is $400 million less than what the federal government would have paid under Senator Tester's bill, that this is still too much money going to the tribes. The tribes would argue that this is just a small fraction of what they're actually owed. And if you look at the legal history of these types of compacts and these types of cases throughout the course of the last 100 years, the law really is on the side of the tribes in this case. And in court case after court case, we've seen the courts side with the original negotiated treaties. And so I think the tribes think that they're getting a fair deal. I think that Senator Daines think that he's getting a great deal for the people of Montana and the taxpayers. And Senator Tester has indicated his support for the bill. So there's bipartisan support now for this legislation.
And with both of Montana's senators expressing support for this, and both of them sitting on the Indian Affairs Committee, is there a sense of how this could track through Congress?
Well, as Senator Tester said when we spoke to him earlier today, his crystal ball is cloudy, and so he doesn't want to make any predictions. But I think there's a lot of optimism that it will pass. It does have bipartisan support from Montana's two senators. And the Trump administration indicated its support for the compact last month when Secretary of the Interior David Barnhart wrote a letter to Senator Daines saying that it was in the best interest of everybody for this to be settled through negotiations, not through litigation. And that was a sentiment that was echoed by Attorney General William Barr, who also said that this settlement negotiation was important. And so I think that there is a sense that this is something that needs to get done, and there's bipartisan support. So I think there's some optimism here. But if it doesn't get done, then a lot of Montana irrigators could be facing costly litigation in the future.
What's next when this bill drops to the public? It's still, we haven't seen it yet as of this taping. But what's next in its process, its introduction, and getting it passed in Congress?
Well, I talked to some folks in Senator Daines' office, and they were pretty clear that they want to get this bill introduced this week. If that happens, then I think there'll be a move to move it through committee. It will go to the Indian Affairs Committee. And so, as Senator Tester said, he's going to be pushing on his leadership, and he expects that Senator Daines will be pushing on Leader McConnell to move this legislation quickly. It sounds like there's going to be another stay, an extension on a stay in water court right now that will prevent costly litigation for at least another year. But if this doesn't get resolved, if this bill doesn't pass by the time that stay expires, a lot of water users across Montana could find themselves in court.
John Adams is the editor-in-chief of the Montana Free Press. John, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
My pleasure, Corin.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.